session number 17729, rule 4.
Right. Rule 4.
Yeah. The pilot navigator went into the main briefing room, and then eventually the whole crew would come together. That's the bomb aimer, the wireless operator, the flight engineer, the two air gunners. So that were five of us going in with the pilot navigator. And we go into the main briefing room, and there would be the target. You never went direct to any target. You always done dog legs. And on that particular occasion that night, there'd be probably there'd be Stirlings going to the Kiel Canal and Wellingtons dropping mines. There'd be probably mosquitoes going to another target as a spoof target. There'd be this target and so on. Now, that was to more or less tell the Germans that what the primary target wasn't. But they seemed to know, irrespective of how many other spoof targets we went to, because they used to make spoof targets of their own and fires and all that kind of carry on. And some of our lads were misled and went to those places. After the main briefing, we were briefed by the Met officer, the signals officer, the gunnery officer, the navigation officer. Then the CO, the squadron, used to come and do that. Then the station commander, which is Group Captain Christie, AFC. And sometimes, occasionally, the base commander was the Air Commodore Hesketh, but mostly the group AOC, which was Air Vice Marshal Cochran. He'd come along and he'd attend it unless it was a special target. We'd come out of there. We'd go down and get our air crew supper, which consisted of egg and bacon, beans. We'd be given tins of orange juice and sweet ration. We'd go then, taken in all our kit by car, by van or vehicle, round to the dispersal where the Lancaster was. And then eventually we'd get aboard. And if the operation was on a green, very cartridge, you'd be fired. We'd sort of rev up and go right and take off. If it was scrubbed, they used to fire a red one. And the van would come around then trying to pick up the sweet ration which they'd given you. But quite honestly, you'd see them jamming it down the mouths and all this kind of carrying. In our squadron, if you had an early return, a lot of the chaps used to come back on early return for any excuse at all. The CO used to make you strip off of all your clothing. In your air clothing, you wore John L's, you wore a thermal vest, then over that you wore your battle dress. You wore two pairs of socks and woolen socks, and above your battle dress you had like a sidcot, which was linked up to the electrics of the electrical installation of the aircraft. Sometimes it didn't work, so we didn't have it. And then over that, you wore your Irvine jacket, and so on and so forth. And then eventually, when you came back, prior to going in the target, with all that aircraft in the sky, one would think you'd see aircraft all over the place. Well, that wasn't the case at all, especially on a moonlight night. If you saw a Lancaster in the distance or something like that, but they were all around you, but somehow you never seemed to see them. They're either going through clouds or something. And when you approached the target itself, you opened the bomb doors and you couldn't move your turrets at all on the running end of the target, which may last 2 or 3 minutes because the navigator would be lining it up and making sure it was right and putting the switches on the bombs and all that. And the skipper would keep it steady, the aircraft steady, 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 until bombs gone. And once the bombs had gone, depending if you had a 4,000 pounder on board and the rest of the bombs, the aircraft used to shoot up in the air. Excuse me, when you got into the target itself, there were Lancasters all over the place. You'd see Lancasters going on fire, coming down in front of you. You see bombs going down. There were aircraft above you and everything else. We were always about 20,000 feet. We had a Canadian four-bladed, paddle-bladed props, so seemed to give us height and everything else. We saw one night above Berlin a mosquito coned in searchlights. The searchlights were a main radio beam with about four or five other ones and used to co-center on an aircraft, and then either a fighter would go up the beams and shoot you down, or the flak and so on. You come out the target and so on and so forth. Well, after the first Berlin trip, we couldn't believe it. We got back into base and so on. And
what did Berlin look like the first time was from the air?
The target itself, from the air itself, when you were approaching the target, you could see the fire, the PFF, they dropped the flares down, and a beautiful sight, really. I've got an actual film of the raid itself over Germany. Have you ever seen it? Have you seen the raid? Raids? Yes. I've got one of those. And you see the fire, and you'd be looking out. You see, if there was stacks of flak inside the target, there were no fighters. There were no flak. The flak was low. There were fighters all over the place. But there were fighters all the way in from the... once you touch the borders of France into Germany. We were attacked a few times, as I'll relate to you later on. I think we were attacked them 7 or 8 times. And you never knew where they were coming from. But in the target, you'd see the fighters, and you'd see the aircraft going down, and so on and so forth. It would just be a vast red, and as if, basically speaking, it was a cauldron boiling, with the bombs going down, and the quake of the earth below, and that was in the fire itself. And it wasn't a nice sight in any way at all. And in the target, there'd be a master of ceremonies. Now, if he was shot down, the deputy master would take over all this, so on. The master of ceremonies was generally a group captain, and his deputy was a wing commander. Sometimes they were in a mosquito, because they used to go in and out the target all the time. And he'd call you in and tell you you're on the fourth wing, you're in the fourth. You were in waves. You couldn't all bomb together, it'd be impossible. You'd all get collisioned over the target. So say there was 800 bombers over the target. Well, you're coming in waves. You could be in your wave. It could be about 50 bombers or 75 bombers. And it'd give you a magnetic heading what to bomb on. The navigator would set his compass and so on and so forth. The pilot would set his compass from the information from the navigator. And group might be on, or bomber command, giving radio messages that of this formation and a call sign and so on and so forth. And we go in and do the bombing, and then there'd be a place where you come out that there'd be a fighter flare drop. Funny enough, the fighter flare was, it should have been dropped by our people, but generally dropped by the Germans, because they already knew the target. You know, when you were at your station, people could practically tell where the target was within about 20 miles by the amount of the petrol load and the amount of the bomb load, you know, how far you were going. You know, if it was a big petrol load, they knew they were going to Leipzig, something like that kind of carry on. But somehow, it was known that there was a pub in Lincoln called the Saracen's Head. All the aircrews used to get there. We didn't go in that particular pub, we went somewhere else. But it was known for the fact that within 10 minutes of the station knowing what the target was, or the aircrew there, you'd go to Saracen's Head in Lincoln and find out what the target was. And that was borne out eventually, because we were, well, I'll tell you later on, eventually come back to your station, and then you'd land and so on and so forth, and then you'd go into debriefing, where you'd receive a cup of hot tea. Some stations received hot tea laced with rum. We never got any rum any time at all, only on one occasion. And then weary and so on and so forth, you'd go and put your kit and hang them up and make your way down to the sergeant's mess, as we were at the time, where you'd get your breakfast before you went to bed. Well, you could be sometimes 5 or 6 hours asleep, then suddenly they'd push you on the shoulder, you're on ops again tonight. You could do consecutive ops like that. Sometimes you could do the space of 2 or 3 days. On this occasion, really speaking, when we went to Berlin, that was on the 23rd, and yet we were on ops again on the 27th, and we went to Nuremberg. And Nuremberg was a heck of a distance away, and that was another raid we took part in. That was our second operation over Germany.
Any memories of that raid?
There's nothing down. This is the what I'm quoting from is the navigator's logbook. I didn't keep my logbook. I didn't keep anything. As a matter of fact, I had an Irvine jacket when I came out, but I was so broke, I sold it. It didn't mean anything to me at all. I kept my uniform for the simple reason that I came out in 1948. Excuse me. And joined the reserves, exactly, so I needed my uniform. I only joined the RAF thing. I joined the RAF up there purely simply because it was extra cash. Weekend camp and that kind of carry on. The next operation we did was to Hagen in the valley, the Royal Valley, and we done that on the 1st of October. And then the valley, it's called, we were shot up by another Lancaster over the target.
On the Hagen Road?
From the Hagen Road, yes. Shot up. The flap was damaged, badly damaged. But the story was at that time, and it was never proved, that the Germans had got hold of a couple of Lancasters and put air gunners aboard them, their own air gunners, you know, and came in the stream, and we couldn't fight. The aircraft had shot us up. We didn't know. We just saw the Lancaster, and we brought its verification, its squadron letters. And it was a squadron letter that, really speaking, we found out later on, there was no aircraft of that squadron in that particular wave. So the only thing they came out was the fact that the Germans was a Lancaster up there. And then we went on ops on the 1st of October to the Ruhr Valley, and we went on another op on the 2nd of October, and that was to Munich. And then we went on a third op, so that was 3 in 3 days. We went to Frankfurt. Now, our starboard wingtip, 6 foot of that, had been shot away, objective wingtip itself. But that was done by flak. And then on the 7th of October, we went to Stuttgart. And we were diverted to Thorny Island because our station had been attacked by enemy fighters. So that's where we went to. And then we went on the 18th of October to Hamburg. We were attacked by two enemy fighters, a JU-88 and a Focke-Wulf 190. We claimed the Focke-Wulf 190, the JU-88. No, we claimed the JU-88. That had come on side on, and that we, the rear gunner, myself, we seemed to get hits on it, and we claimed some damage at least. The Focke-Wulf 190 came underneath and raked out the underside of the aircraft, and we engaged that as well. And then we went on the 20th of October to Leipzig. The navigators got here, terrific storms, and the cloud base was up to 20,000 feet. And we bombed the target from 24,000 feet. Within 2 days, we'd gone to a place called Kassel. Electric storms and so on and so forth.
What was it like firing back at the German night fighters?
I don't know if you know it or not, with bullets, not trying to insult your intelligence, but when you're firing your guns, they went on a curve of pursuit. You know, they couldn't go. It's impossible to go direct because the bullet used to go on like a curve and so on and so forth. The fighters themselves, we used to fire tracer bullets, so you could see exactly where they were going. We fired hundreds and hundreds of rounds of ammunition, didn't mean to hit the aircraft each time. But funny enough, you could see this happening because it was so close to us. But there again, he was firing at us, and you could see his bullets coming at us, and they were going into the wingtip and underneath the side because we were damaged underneath and all that business. Now, when we were firing our guns, the one thing you didn't want to do was, you know, we saw quite a few German fighters. We didn't mean to say we pulled our guns and said we fired at them right away. If they weren't after you, there's no point in going after them. Just no point at all. Our object was to get to the target and drop the bombs. We weren't there basically to have an aerial combat, just because there was a German fighter there. If the German fighter could be on the beam or something like that kind of business, unless he was coming in to attack, You engage the fighter itself. It's no use being in the bomber itself and you've got like a full bomb load on. You could well be, you could attack you. If he wasn't attacking you, if he's going in a different direction, well, that's fine. Let him get on with it. But the fact, once he came into attack, you either corkscrewed, and the corkscrew was more or less dive to starboard, climb to port, and so on and so forth. You'd done like a corkscrew in the sky. Especially with the bomb load on, it was a horrible experience. Because, in the aircraft in those days, with a full bomb load on, it was a hell of a thing, and a full petrol load and all that business, and diving and weaving around the sky was a hell of a situation. insofar as when the fighters were coming in to us, the funny part about the aircraft, that really speaking, we identified the JU-88. Now, a JU-88 attacking us in midstream, which is more or less a bomber, it is a bomber. The bombers used to come over here and bomb here, but a Focke-Wulf 190. Where a JU-88, it's like, it's not the size of a Lancaster, but it's big enough to identify. The Focke-Wulf 190 came under the turret because we felt the damage underneath, and as it flew up, it flew right up. And, you know, you could identify it right away. But that was one shot, one burst, and right up. The JU-88 practically flew alongside of us and done the guns that way, you know. There was no damage from the JU-88, but we engaged it. We engaged because, really speaking, the JU-88, it came from starboard to port, came right across our vision. And the rear gunner engaged it first of all, and they flew in such an angle that it came across my turret, and I engaged it as well. And where we could see our trace, the trace was going into the underside on the port side of the JU-88, but the Focke-Wulf 190, it was so fast you didn't see it. You know, it was just going past you. And once it had raked the aircraft, it went round again to come and rake us again, and raked us again. And there was no chance of firing at it. Although we fired the guns, we didn't see it coming in because there's nothing underneath. There was no belly turret in the thing itself. All of a sudden, like that, you see. That kind of carry on. And then, on the, see now, the next stop was a place called Madain. Now, that was in France. There was a tunnel there, a military tunnel. We got a citation for that. I've got that upstairs.
What date is this?
Madain was on the 10th of November. It's a thing of a Lancaster, and a photograph of a Lancaster, and the crew's names underneath. I was a sergeant at the time, and we got the aiming point for it, and it's signed by the AOC. And the next one after that was on the 22nd of November, let's see now, the 18th of November, when we went to Berlin again. There's nothing to report on that, we just went to Berlin. And then on the 4 days later, we went to Berlin again. And the next day, we went to Berlin again. And 2 days after that, we went to Berlin again. So, really speaking, we've done four Berlins, one after another. Now, on the 26th of November, we lost an engine. And we had to land at a place called Melbourne, which is in Yorkshire. Now, Melbourne was a satellite station, which was under construction. So when you took your aircraft down the end of the runway, there was generally a perimeter where you went left or right. But there was no perimeter there. So we had to bring the aircraft back up again. And as we were coming back up again, there was another aircraft flown by a flying officer Featherstone from our own squadron. It was coming into land. So we all jumped out the aircraft, and he went into our Lancaster and blew it up, smashed it up completely. So we had to stay in Melbourne for 2 or 3 days. And it was a good thing, really, because on that particular age, I had problems. My oxygen mask became detached for some unknown reason, plus the fact that with my heavy breathing, my mask became frozen, so I couldn't speak. We went to Berlin, and we had problems. we lost an engine and various other things that happened. And I was off oxygen for some considerable time. And the bomb aimer, Frank Beddingham, and the wireless operator, Jack Olson, were trying to get me out the turret. Eventually, they laid me down on the fuselage of the aircraft. And I was unconscious for a little time, but I started to come round. But I couldn't make any movements. I'd been off oxygen so long, there was no strength in my arms. And I couldn't speak. And they were hitting me on the head with a torch, shouting, "Come round, Kelly, come round."
Hitting you on the head with what?
A torch, shouting, "Come round, Kelly, come round." Frank Beddingham was getting upset and so on and so forth. And I couldn't speak through the mask because it was been frozen. But eventually, well, I came round and they put me on the sick bed and I came back to Melbourne. We landed at Melbourne because we had problems there. And I had to go to sick quarters. Our aircraft had been written off on the main runway because the aerodrome itself was under construction and there was no perimeter where you could take the aircraft at the bottom of the runway. You had to come back up the runway again. And another aircraft had come in and we saw it coming in to land and we immediately evacuated our aircraft and ours was written off, A for Able. And after about a few days, we came back to base. Skellingthorpe. The next operation we did was Leipzig, and that was on the 3rd of December. Nothing to report. A good prang. We made a good effort there or something. The next operation we did was on the 16th of December when we went to Berlin. The next operation, we was on the 19th of December. Got that wrong, I'm sorry. The next one was on the 20th of December when we went to Frankfurt. Bags of fighters, that's when Heckendorf, another Australian pilot, went down. And eventually the only people who got out of his aircraft was the bomb aimer and the wireless operator. But on that particular night before we went on operations, our flight engineer, we all had bicycles, which took us up from our Nissen huts to the briefing headquarters. And Joe Smith, who was the flight engineer at that time, fell off his bicycle and broke his leg in three places. So we got a substitute engineer. The engineer we got was the CO's engineer, who the CO had finished his second tour of operations, and we got a flight sergeant, Turner. And off he went to Berlin, off he went to Frankfurt. And then the next operation we did was on the Christmas Eve of 1943. And we went to Berlin. And we had a shaky do because we lost. We had a fighter came in and shot one of our engines away. Eventually we came back on Christmas Eve. And we went on the 23rd, the night of the 23rd, and came back on the 24th of December 1943. And we enjoyed the Christmas festivities in the sergeant's mess. The next operation was on the 14th of January, when we went to Berlin. And we had some problems then with one of the engines. The next one, operation, was on the 20th of December, when we went to Berlin again.
20th of January?
Of January, we went to Berlin again. And then we went to Berlin on the 21st again. And then we had some problems then. We lost an engine again and was attacked by fighters and so on and so forth. The next operation we did was on the 27th of January, when for a change we went back to Berlin again. And on that one, we lost two engines.
When you say you lost an engine, what exactly do you
mean? It went on fire. Went on fire. Attacked and went on fire. And then on the 28th, the next day, we went back to Berlin again. And we took with the second pilot. It was the usual course before they done started the tour of operations. They went as a second dickie, and he came along, and he didn't like it at all. He didn't like it. And then...
In what way did he not like it?
Well, he just came and commented. I remember him saying that the comment on over the intercom was, we called the pilot Skipper. We didn't call him Doug, although he used to call me Kelly or Kel. And the second pilot said to Skipper, have you dropped the bombs yet? And they said, no, not yet. He said, well, drop the bloody things and let's get out of here. And then on the 30th of December, we went back to Berlin again. That was on the 30th of January, I should say. And then on the 15th of February, we went to Berlin for a change again. And then on our last trip, which was on the 19th of February, 1944, we had a hell of a trip. We went to Leipzig. And it was the end of our tour, but we got attacked by fighters, and we got damaged, and 16 feet of the wingspan was touched, and something else had happened, and the flap gone, and so on. And the skipper received a DFC and bar within 3 days. That I've got the citation which I showed you before. And that was the end of our 30 trips over Germany. We'd done the most Berlin trips in the whole of Five Group, and Five Group consists of about 500 aircraft. We'd done 13 Berlin trips out of a total of 30 trips. And we'd been attacked a few times and damage done and so on and so forth. But when we'd done our 30 trips, all air crews in Bomber Command, once you'd done your tour of operations, you split up as a crew. And you went different ways instructing and so on and so forth. But we stayed together as a crew. We were called the base experimental and test crew. The crews at that time were complaining that the aircraft, most of the aircraft came from AV Row at Woodford, just outside Manchester. And they'd come to the various bases where there was like a base station with two satellite stations. And there the base used to more or less put modifications on, various modifications, then hand them over to the squadrons. Well, some of them were flown in by ATA pilots or something like that kind of thing. And they'd come to the squadron and they'd be on ops. Could be that night, could be the next day. And of course, a lot of the things weren't ready for an operational raid. So somebody thought of the brilliant idea of having an ex-operational crew. And we'd pick the aircraft up and they'd come to our base. And then we'd do take it to Wayne Fleet for bombing. The radio, with the wireless operator would try for that kind of thing. The navigation for all the aids on that. The flight engineer, the pilot, we'd fly it for about an hour and three quarters. We'd do all the modifications that had to be done, and the guns were trained and ready for that. So when we delivered it to the station, we delivered it to the actual squadron. It was ready for ops that night. Now, got to that state eventually, instead of just doing for our base six stations,